Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is the 12th of July, 2016, and you're listening to episode 149. My name is Chris Thurston. Today I am joined by Pip.
Hi.
And Tom.
Hello.
Truly the only Tom.
Anyone left?
Sweden continues to claim members of our once proud group of people. In this case, claiming Tom Francis only temporarily. We'll get him back in just shy of 2 months. But he's gone to live in the woods.
Is it just shy of 2 months?
It's like 6 weeks.
Oh, I thought it was shy. 1 month, which is, I timed the cherry vodka to steep for his return, but...
Oh, well.
Oh, well, sorry, Tom.
Tom's gone to live in the woods to finish or make progress with his game, Heat Signature, and this was apparently his only recourse after enjoying our company for the better part of a couple of years.
Well, Graham's gone to a distant island.
I was about to say, well, Graham's left the EU. going to Jersey, but...
Yeah, he's gone to Jersey.
Which one of us do you think it is that's driving them away?
Well, I mean, you arrived after several of them left, Pip, so...
So that puts me in the clear, broadly.
Well, you've directly profited. I mean, it's the old, you know, it's the old mystery
the
thing.
Who
profits from this?
You say profit.
Who gets to give up an evening a week thanks to this opportunity, this priceless opportunity that's been granted us by Sweden's voracious appetite for...
Games journalists.
Former games journalists from Bath. Anyway.
Games news.
Games news. Also,
breaking news.
I guess in this case, returning from a mysterious absence-ish... is Overwatch's new character. This was announced about half an hour ago as the time we were recording. Mm. So excuse us if loads more information is known by the time you're listening to this than we know now. But so the first new character in Overwatch has been announced, and as suspected, she's a support sniper, which is an interesting concept worth digging into a bit more. But everyone was expecting it to be a Spanish or Latin American character called Sombra, which was mentioned in a few different cases and even teased by Blizzard. But it turns out to be a character called Anna, who is Farah's mum.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been in a lot of concept art of old Overwatch. And now she's back and she's kind of rad. She looks quite a lot like, I was going to say either Old Lady Big Boss or like a futuristic version of the old ladies in Mad Max Fury Road. Both of which are really cool frames of reference to go to. In fact... one of her legendary skins, which I just saw on Twitter, gives her like a kind of Mad Max-y kind of junkyard scavenger vibe, which may well be a reference to that rad film.
She looks like she's actually dressed like a sniper, unlike the sniper that's in the game already, which is probably one of their worst character designs. The one actually looks like what she does. Like she'd be able to hunker down in an environment, kind of just look like a drift of cloth, but actually be a deadly sniper. Deadly things that she could throw at people that make them fall asleep.
Do you think she's like, kids today at Widowmaker?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're not going out dressed like that.
Yeah,
I mean, exactly. Admittedly, her own daughter is going out dressed like a Gundam. So
that's
awesome. To be fair, that's like, she's got jetpacks and death from above and so forth.
Well, Farah is one of, I mean, I was going to say sensibly dressed, but
from
you know.
Above, raining and so forth.
But what's their surname? Amari. Their line, and now that's pretty good precedent for Overwatch's female characters, because Farah's a pretty rad design as well, because she's just this massive, hulking, winged battle suit.
That's a badass family, isn't it?
Yeah.
That lineage of being a badass sniper, and then your daughter
we're gonna
grows
get
up
eye
to be
tattoos.
A badass.
Yeah. Like, let's get eye tattoos and be the cool things that all the kids wanted to be, either robot pilots or snipers. Her deal is you can shoot allies with her sniper rifle to heal them, or enemies with her sniper rifle to hurt them. She can debuff enemies, which disables healing on them, which is kind of a big deal, given how prevalent healing is in the game, particularly for characters who are quite overpowered at the moment, like Roadhog. And her, she can put people to sleep somehow. And her ult is basically... is it Blitzkrieg? What's the Uber charge that makes you do more damage in TF2? So
Overdrive or something?
Yeah, there's the variant on the Medigun where instead charging up invulnerability, you charge up like quad damage, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is Blitzkrieg, yeah.
It's basically...
It's crits or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kritzkrieg. It's the Kritzkrieg.
Kritzkrieg.
It's kind of like a bit like the Kritzkrieg from Down to the Lightning Effect.
So, I see what they did there.
Valve.
Well, Kritzkrieg,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot of wordplay in that game. A lot of puns. Not very many puns in Overwatch, really. Just very accessible attempts at humour, and that's the kindest thing I could say about it.
Yeah, I agree.
But no, she's rad, actually, and they even did a little bit backstory comic thing for her, and it's one of the better things they've put out, I think. I mean, it's not mind-blowing by any means. It's like, it's the same thing they're all about, which is like, well, weren't we heroes? And I was a hero, but now I'm not a hero, but am I a hero? The end.
Yeah.
But yeah, kind of excited. I'm excited they put I'm excited that the first character is a support, because traditionally it's the thing normals to play. I am happy that the new character is a very active support, not like someone who just hangs around and holds down a button. And also that they've sort of had a bit of a go at changing what being a sniper means in a game, because it feels like if there was any way to get the players that instant pick Widowmaker every game to even consider playing a support, this is how you cater to them, which is by showing them a sniper rifle and then showing you a video where that person kills Widowmaker with it.
Yeah.
So that there's an obvious choice. Yeah, yeah, it is.
I'm not sure. Like, it's one of those things that I'm like going to... I'm interested to see how it shakes out, because it's one of those things where if they get it wrong, or if it feels not as much fun to play as you'd hope, then you can see the people who gravitate towards snipers exclusively still picking Widowmaker. Mm-hmm. And so I think that perhaps, I'm interested to see what is it that they call their test realm? Is it the public test realm,
PTR, or
is it
like normally.
Because I was going to say, there are so many different names for them out there. There's the public beta environment, the PTR. It's, anyway. But I'm interested to see how it actually shakes out in reality, and whether the reason that people pick snipers will trump the reason that people pick support. I mean, the reason people don't pick support.
Yeah, I don't necessarily anticipate it will have a huge effect, but it's... It's far better than the alternative, which is they add a new sniper, which the game doesn't need, or they add like a new offensive sniper or defensive sniper, or that they just add a different type of character that the game arguably doesn't really need as much as it needs greater variety among the supports, particularly while Zenyatta is still basically broken. It's the sort of most anemic part of the roster in terms of how viable different characters are. Like, you can...
Is Zenyatta broken because you can stack Zenyattas? Because they're taking it out of competitive, aren't they? Is it true that they're going to add a one type of character? Like, you can't have duplicates?
I didn't hear that. Zenyatta's broken because he's terrible.
Right, okay.
Like, he used to be amazing in the beta when his like debuff and debuff orbs worked differently.
Right.
They didn't require him to have line of sight. He could place something on somebody and then hide.
I remember those days.
And he was great. But he was really overpowered. But the problem with that is his health pool is tiny. It's mostly shield, so it regenerates, but it's teeny. Hmm. And for a long time, Widowmaker could one-shot him. And he previously mitigated that by hiding. You'd put your healing orb out and your Discord orb out and hide. Or, like, at least, you know, hide, get behind cover and stuff. But now that you need to maintain line of sight, he has to kind of be out in the open. But that is the worst possible place for him to be.
Right.
And everyone else in the game...
destroyed
shits
him.
On him
okay.
quite heavily. So there isn't, like, you know, there's just no scenario, I think, in the game as it currently stands where you go, what we need here is Zenyatta, rather than saying, say, Lucio or Mercy. D.Va has a similar problem. Like, there's basically no situation where you'd say we need D.Va rather than Winston, okay. I think.
Right.
But the very least, the support end of the roster needs a bit of love, I think. So it's really nice that this is the direction they've chosen to take it.
Do you think this says anything about the frequency of updates that we can expect? Obviously, it's the first one, so you can't say, oh, it's going to be 3 months to the next one.
But I don't know, actually, because for me, I always, until they explicitly said they were going to be adding more characters, I always conceived of it as a closed loop almost, or some kind of rock, paper, scissors arrangement where things had a counter and it worked in a particular way, because that would encourage people to keep swapping. And something that I just sort of thought was that the game wouldn't necessarily sustain a huge hero pool in the way that a MOBA does.
Yeah.
And so I think I was surprised just even knowing that they were going to add more after release. I mean, it makes sense, but the way I'd conceived it in my head, I was like, well, they've sort of closed the gaps that existed early on in the beta by adding the rest of the characters.
Right.
And then I wasn't necessarily expecting them to that to be the way that they diversified or kept the game alive.
Mm. I think, yeah, I'm interested in that as well, because at the moment, I think there's room for them to add stuff. Like, given that it's game so much about picking and counterpicking heroes based on the situation and so on, there are still areas that you could flesh out, and I think this is a good example of it. Maybe for reasons going too further, but eventually I think you do surely run out of space, and if you keep going at that point, surely once you get to the 30-40 hero mark, even if that's in a couple of years, the game becomes completely crazy, because you can't, how do you, like, Dota wouldn't work if you could change hero at any time. It would be mad. I mean, there's a mode in Dota, or random deathmatch, which basically shifts people's heroes in that way randomly, and it's mad for that reason.
Yeah.
And Overwatch is okay because it's kind of manageable. You go, we need a healer, and you have a limited number of choices.
Mm.
And so it's like, okay, we need a healer. Which of these five is good in this scenario?
Well, I think that also the ethos that they had with the game was that they clearly wanted it to be pick up and playable. You know, it would take a long time to master things to a hugely high level in an ideal world. But I think, especially with the, you know, press F1 for a basic summary of just, you know, abilities and things like that, that they wanted it to be that pick up and playable. And if you get to the point where you have an unmanageable roster and somebody looks at it and just has total panic when faced with even just the choice of starter hero and can't work out how to pick or counterpick or respond to a situation, then I think that would start to fly in the face of what they initially wanted from the game.
I feel like it's almost already there as it is, because and not so much in, like, it does a very good job of telling you what heroes are for and giving you, like, pushing people to get a good healthy team makeup, but the problem comes in recognizing enemy skills and effects. And there are already hundreds of effects you have to kind of know and recognize and understand in the game. And every time you add another hero, it's just another number of effects and things you have to look out for that people will shout at you for not recognizing. so I feel like the game is already at the tipping point for that.
If they can maintain the amount of work they do, like Overwatch, we've talked about this before, but Overwatch is notable for the amount of work Blizzard have done to pack the game with cues that make it easier to pass. So the fact that every single hero in the game has a different footstep sound.
Yeah, the sound design is incredible.
Like, so the sound design is a big part of it. And so if they commit to that and every hero sounds different, I think you will absorb it. I can say from Dota, imagine Pip might be able to back this up, that you'd be surprised how much becomes just normal and how many different characters you can recognize on sight and so on. And
yeah, I think it's one of those things where I obviously can't come at it from the other direction, though. So I look at it as something that is just so much less intensive than Dota in terms of things I need to remember and things that I need to be on top of and item builds and skill trees and things like that. But and so for me, it's like, oh, this is almost like a brain holiday in some ways. Yeah. But then coming at it from the other direction, if you're maybe used to having one character in an RPG and getting to know them and really customize them and specialize, then I can see that it might go the other direction, even with the cues and the tooltips that pop up and things like that.
It's always interesting. I mean, it's obvious to compare it to TF2, but I think it's interesting to see where those different games put their complexity, where they add their complexity. So with TF2, it's loadouts, and for me, like, it's gone, there was a tipping point where it became too mad, with the loadouts, you didn't know what a sniper could really do, and you didn't really know what a soldier could do because their weapons were so varied and different. But it lasted a long time before it hit that point, because you could log into that game for the first 3 years and fundamentally understand what each of the classes would do, even with different loadouts. And you'd understand when you saw the shimmer of a spy or the silhouette of a sniper on a balcony what that was and how to deal with it. And it feels like the visual element of Overwatch is where all the complexity is for so many new heroes and so many new effects and so many new kind of things to listen out for and to look out for. Like, and that's an overwhelming thing, I think, for new players. That's certainly something I found with the game compared to Team Fortress 2, which is a rare competitive shooter that I actually got into. Because I am the sort of person who... I've had good times with hyper-competitive shooters when I'm playing with a group of friends and that kind of thing, but it feels like Overwatch is very much designed to be, you should be able to just quick play and have a good time. And it's really not that for me at the moment.
Something that I find quite frustrating about it is that middle ground in terms of strategizing, because I think in terms of it being pick up and play-ish, you're expecting to try and get loads of kills, or, you know, maybe sort of you're not thinking in terms of working with other people, even though it is a co-op game. And so I kind of understand when we're in situations where maybe you're trying to take an objective and everybody has their own idea of how to do that, and there's such a sort of sense of, you know, every man is an island and I'm going to just sort of be completely out of sync with everybody else, because I think it's so hard to build any sense of sort of trust or back and forth when the games are so short and when you're so limited in how you can communicate. And that's not to say it's impossible or that loads of people don't approach it wanting to do those things. It's more that I am not surprised when it doesn't work.
I think that for that reason, the King of the Hill mode, which they added quite late, which is where the map has a single capture point that both teams fight over, it's really straightforward. King of the Hill mode is by far the best thing in the game.
Right.
Like, it's interesting in that because it solves so many of the problems that the payload and straight up sort of like attack defend formats have, which is, in those formats, it's fine to want to go and kill people and run around and do stuff, but that won't win you the game, because the thing you should be doing, the strategically optimal thing, won't always be kill lots of people. Obviously, killing lots of people helps, but, like, you know, you can end up in interesting strategic situations where if the thing you succeed in doing is making the other team's Genji chase you around for ages, that will actually probably win your team the game, because he's wasting time. Like, there's a sort of, like, it's great for coordinated teams and pretty terrible for random groups a lot of the time. Whereas King of the Hill, I think the maps are better designed for one thing, but also there's one objective and everyone kind of understands it, and the maps are a little bit smaller. So it kind of allows all of Overwatch's different elements to come off quite well, I think, because it's just one big team fight forever. And when you die, you just run back to the big fight. And you can do plays, you can come in together, you can wait by the door so you all go in at the same time, and it's, you know, use abilities in different ways, like the main game. So it's not reduced to the point where it's just a big scrap. But because there's one objective, I think it's much more pleasant for teams with random people, because even if you're not communicating at all, you all agree where the thing you need to take is. And similarly, and this will be an interesting thing with the new character as well, like, the attack defend format makes team composition really important, because, you know, I mean, I imagine so many people playing attack on Overwatch have quit in frustration because their team is all snipers or like flanking characters that don't want to stand on a payload. Like, Farah is a good example of a character who's great and, you know, I love her, but she should never be standing on a capture point because she's a jetpack lady with rockets and that's just not where you put her. And you get like four Farahs and a Widowmaker and no one wants to be on the point and you lose. Whereas that can kind of be made to work in a King of the Hill format. You can have snipers, and the adding a new sniper is interesting, but it's specifically interesting because pub teams, I would find, have a lot of trouble on attack getting the momentum necessary to succeed when they have snipers, because that means turns every fight essentially into at least a 5v6, unless the sniper's amazing and able to contribute like someone who's there.
It's interesting that the idea of concentrating everything onto one point, because it feels as though the more time you're in, time in active combat is learning time in Overwatch. Mm. Like, that's when you're observing how all of the skills of these many different characters interact, and you're hearing the sounds and learning those, forming those connections. And if you go into the payload mode, you tend to get very fragmented, often lopsided encounters where you really can't learn much at all. And that's like a deeply frustrating thing, especially with like a long, minute-long run to get back into things.
On Hanamura, I've been on the receiving end of like a proper like face rolling, and they're the ones where you sort of want to learn the most, and they're the ones where you learn the least, because obviously it was over too quickly and you clearly had no idea what you were doing wrong.
Right.
And so it was over. That's clearly a situation that you're no good at, but what's the takeaway? It's just that, oh, well, that was a minute.
Yeah.
Wow. That also hurt.
Simply the fact that in King of the Hill, if you don't play the game, the way it works is you capture the central point, and then the bar, basically a percentage ticks up for your team, and whoever reaches 100% first wins the round, and it's best of three. Unless the bar is at 99% and capping it will end the round for your team, losing the point once isn't a huge deal. Mm. You can regroup and come back, whereas losing the point once in a straightforward attack defend, well, that point's just gone now and you've got to move on to the next one.
Yeah.
And that emphasizes something which, you know, if you watch any play of the game, it goes the same way. Like, the way Overwatch works, a big ult can turn a point for a team.
Mm.
Like, you know, the amount of times people will cynically say, and now Reaper is going to press Q now, is in another play of the game. Reaper drops out of nowhere, or Junkrat puts a tire in, or Pharah ults, and suddenly the point belongs to their team. Those moments can happen in King of the Hill, and they do. But unless it's at the end of a close round, in which case it's a big clutch play anyway, it's not like, oh, we just lost because of that.
Yeah.
And because there's so much going on in Overwatch, you can't really be expected to protect against everything at all times. Like, Reaper will drop out of the sky and just press Q sometimes, and there's not a lot you can do about that. It's not something, again, it's not like something like Dota, where you know all of the parts that are in play on the enemy team, and you've got 40 minutes to get used to how they're going to use them. And if they have a character with a big AoE ultimate that you need to be aware of, that will be part of your life for 40 minutes that you'll be constantly aware of. It'll be, don't group up, they've got Magnus, or something like that.
Yeah.
And whereas in Overwatch, they can change. You just sometimes Genji, you know, it's just, you can't really plan for it in that way. So having those moments where someone just dumps on you, turn again completely and instantly, can be quite unsatisfying. Because you have that moment of, this is close, we've lost.
What's Anna's, not passive, but you know how Widowmaker can grapple up to spaces and things? Does Anna have that as well?
I don't think so. So that's the thing that hasn't been revealed. Maybe it might be on the website and might well be out by the time people listen to this. They didn't show her movement power. Because every character pretty much has something.
Because I'm just thinking, that just came off the back of idly pondering the actual positioning, how that will turn out to be optimal for Widowmaker's technically listed as defensive, but for a support sniper, how that's going to differ. Is it going to be the same sniper positions, but one objective behind so that you can snipe at the sniper to keep the sniper healthy? Or is it going to be sort of a completely different set of positions and things like that? Because I think that could be interesting as well, how you strike that balance, or whether you are essentially being forced to choose between doing a health boosting like run or doing an offensive run, like how variable you can be.
I imagine she'll have something just because all the other snipers do.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the other thing I just wanted to say, and it's going to sound like it comes slightly out of left field because I left it quite late, but I was interested in the other discussions we were having, is just that I'm super pleased about the fact that she's an elderly lady badass and is kind of an interesting riff on sniping, and there's already a sort of, hopefully, an interesting female relationship then built into the game, even if they don't write it interestingly. But the one thing that I am keeping a kind of eye on is the fact that the support category is the only one where there was gender parity, and then it's now the only one where there are more characters with a female pronoun than male.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the only thing that I'm slightly wary of, because it plays into sort of women as support tropes.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard to get around that one in some ways. Like, in this case, because you're absolutely right. But it's also, it would be notable, for example, if Anna was male, if she was, like, you know, Soldier 76, or like, given that she's Soldier 76's age, like a white-haired dude, then you would say, like, okay, well, they've added a new male support character, but they had to give him, like, a kind of traditional kind of soldiery military aspect rather than, like, a full sort of supportive healer thing. Well, like Mercy.
I say, I mean, I'm not objecting to anything exactly. It's more that that's the only thing that I am keeping an eye on, I guess, because it's the one thing where I'm... The rest of it, it feels like they've got really well done or have got a good handle on. It's just that one thing that I was aware of simply because I totted up the characters in each thing, because I tend to with games to just sort of keep an eye on the representation, and then just because it's interesting to me what people choose to put where. And then it just struck me that was the category which skewed towards women and all the others didn't, essentially. So it's more just a kind of, observation. And if it is one of those things where you end up with a Dota-style roster and there's, like, 30 ladies in the support character category, then it would be worth sort of more than a,
bit. Trying to figure out what Overwatch's balance is in the others. Tank is 3 and 2, I think. Yes, it is. 5 of them, 3 men, 2 women. Defense is probably the only one that's closest to even.
There's Zarya.
Sorry.
Oh, hang on. No, sorry. We're talking. Yeah, defense. So there's Widowmaker counts as defense.
Widowmaker, May.
And May. And then there's 3 guys, I think.
Depending on if Bastion is male, which is a pedantic kind of thing to me.
Isn't it 4 then? Aren't there 6?
Oh shit, yeah. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, that is actually really unbalanced. Because so, you've got Chobon, Bastion, Hanzo. Hang on.
And Genji? No, Genji's attack.
So that one's 3 and 2 as well.
Possibly. I'm so sure that there's someone we're missing. Anyway, it doesn't.
Junkrat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Like, yeah, I guess if
we could see how what they do next and how they actually
expand each of those things,
isn't it? And yeah, it's right.
Like, I'm not raising it as a kind of I'm outraged by this. It really is just a But
they tease 2 new characters in the Anna lore movie, vaguely, and that's 1 male, 1 female. So I suspect for reasons of variety over time, it'll probably be not a support and probably not a female character next, just because that's the way these things tend to go. But yeah, it'd be nice to see them skew towards adding more female characters just to balance the roster out.
Mm.
What's everyone been playing?
I think I and Pip have both been playing Inside.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. the new, what Andy Kelly of PC Gamer calls the sad boy walking sideways genre that Play Dead have mastered, it seems, with both Limbo and this, which is a
What other games would you include in sad boy walking sideways?
Braid. I don't know how old the main character in Braid is, or it's if he's like even a sad
20 something sad math student.
Sad, sad failed poet walks sideways through time.
Yeah, I think there were a few games like that at recent sort of indie expos as well.
Well, it's what indie game means, Pip. If you look up indie game, it just means a sad boy walking sideways.
So I've finished Inside, which means there's stuff I can't say at all about it. I mean, it's a deeply mysterious game anyway. There's no kind of greater plot or truth to it. There's just kind of vibe and themes. And it's a very much an ambience piece as much as anything else. And as a piece of ambience, I think it's pretty exceptional in terms of the mood it creates and the kind of the violence and horror of it and the subtlety of the way it delivers a lot of that stuff is really clever. It's beautifully animated, and it looks
amazing. I was going to say, it's the animation, like the little touches, actually, in how the boy moves are exquisite, just in terms of the way that... Because I got to a door and had to wait for a thing just before we started recording this podcast, and he puts his hands up against the door and looks through the window on it, and it's, you know, it's an idle animation, but it's... It's so lovely and appropriate to the context, and also fits with an actual character in a world doing things. I mean, he's still obviously not... he's kind of a thing that you direct to do things, obviously, and is a tool, and sort of certainly haven't.
What a tool.
I haven't learned much about him, and it sounds like I probably won't as the game progresses. But he does things like, I was walking along and there were a couple of menacing looking things that I hadn't activated yet, but I noticed that when he's walking past them on his way to do a thing that you need to do before you activate them, the character's gaze is on them as he runs forward to the right hand side of the screen, rather than, you know, in the direction of movement, which is what the lazy option would be to do. He seems to respond to those things, and sort of the swimming animations are really lovely, and the noise as well. The sound design is properly wonderful, and none of it sounds out of place.
There's almost no music in the game. It's just entirely the kind of rustling and crunching of his footsteps, and
the horrible crack when he jumps too far, sort of feel his ankle go, but he doesn't die, and you're like,
there are so many animations for him landing a non-fatal height from a non-fatal height, and him just kind of stumbling and falling down. Sometimes he falls down and stops and has to get up again.
Sometimes he rolls as well.
Yeah, sometimes he rolls. Sometimes he just stumbles and makes it and just recovers.
Yeah.
And all that variation is just so human, and really it's an amazing study in how to make you invest in your avatar just through movement. And it reminds me of Shadow of the Colossus. And Shadow of the Colossus, like, you're playing like a young teen, and the way they communicate that is through this kind of adolescent flailing and this almost like slight lack of control over his own limbs, and he stumbles a lot, and he falls over, and there's imperfection in his movements, and that's what Limbo and this even more so does very, very well.
So, as somebody who hasn't played it, what's the theme? Like, what's the kind of... Given that Limbo is terrible and Spider Nightmare Forest.
Yeah, so sad boy. He's running sideways to the right, and he's
sometimes to the left, but not for long.
Not for long. For puzzle purposes, he might go left. And he's in a dark forest, and as he's running right, there are just kind of vans pulling up and men who will smother him to death if they see him. And they're roaming the forest with flashlights, and it's just a very strange, nightmarish kind
it's
of kind place
of,
to be.
Well, it's a dystopian landscape with, you know, elements that are typical to that genre, really. And I don't... It's one of those things where I'm so reluctant to give further information.
That's okay,
in particular, just but it's that sense of it's such a similar aesthetic to Limbo as well. Yeah. And it's although it does some really interesting things with colour at various points. And so I am just sort of, I've taken so many screenshots as well. But there is a kind of weird menace, but occasionally it dips over into being quite funny. And I don't know whether there's just something wrong with me or whether it's actually...
I'm trying to think of the funny bits, and I'm struggling.
It's not like laugh out loud funny. It's more just that it sometimes seems to have a tiny dash of humour, if that... I don't know if that makes sense.
Would playfulness be a...
No. No, and like I say, the more I talk, the more I'm worried that this is just me.
It's hilarious. Laugh a minute.
It's not that. I think it's more that it's kind of the over-the-topness of it sometimes gets to you, and sometimes you're just like... It raises a smile simply because of that, and because if you've failed a thing a lot of times, then you sort of, there's that, not exactly exasperated, but because I haven't encountered any puzzles that have properly sort of flummoxed me or anything, but there's been moments where I think the best way to explain it is when, you know, it's one of those games where sometimes you are just running and you have absolutely no idea whether just running was the actual solution or whether you're going to massively like run into a brick wall and get savaged by a dog, which is just going to come out of nowhere. And you sort of hope that you're interpreting the cues that the game gives you and that it's not just going to sort of step back and go, ah, ha, 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 no.
Does that quite often
at some point. And so there's like a kind of there's some moments of humor where you can kind of see what it's doing in that regard. There's a bleak sort of amusement. Yeah,
it lays traps for you, and because it punishes you so brutally for the falling into them, that there is, I could see what you mean, that there is a kind of like, oh yeah, you got me. And that's kind of an amusement. There's an amusement to that.
Yeah, like bleak amusement is probably
sort of
the best.
Maybe a black horror, black comedy, sorry.
No, it's so not anywhere near comedy. Like, comedy is not the word.
Well, no, but, you know, like a kind of morbid humour maybe, or...
I really don't know, because I know that a few people have played it and just really didn't find any humour in it. So I think it might just be to do with personal reactions to the way design choices play out. And so for me, yeah, I find that type of puzzle and that type of sort of dialogue almost with the game developer to be quite interesting and sometimes does raise a smile. But I know that some people will just find it massively frustrating or want to throw it in the bin and walk away.
Yeah, that's exactly it, actually. It is that conversation you're having with the developer, and there are points where the developer just goes, no, you don't get to live at this point. And you're just like, oh, I knew you were going to do that. And it's, yeah, and it's good at that. It's also, it's horrible as well. Like, it's because the executions of the boy are so brutal when you get chased down by a dog and your throat ripped out and he ragdolls and blood spurts out. It's like, this child has just been ripped apart by an animal there.
Yeah, and they don't really shy away from that one.
In fact, I mean, there are points where you frankly can't possibly anticipate what you're supposed to do to react to a situation where it's one of the frustrations of the game, because it is, a lot of it is about trial and error in portions. But I think maybe that's intentional, because they want you to see those deaths and they want you to kind of get a sense of that you're always in peril. And they don't have like a giant spider to do it.
But there's also so much variety within that, which is one of the things that has been interesting, because if you get stuck on a particular bit, you'll see the same death animation over and over. But if you're sort of chipping away at it, making progress, or, you know, you sort of die every few screens or whatever, then there are a lot of different ways in which that boy can end up. The one thing that I would say is I generally really like that you do not have a user interface like at all. Like, it doesn't even tell you the controls when you first get in the game. You just are supposed to get on with it, really. And that's all fine, but I am so not quite getting the hang of how much time I have underwater.
Right. Yeah, he kind of chokes. And I think you get like 3 chokes before he dies
horribly. Yeah. Yeah, but the thing that I'm trying to do, I'm sort of too far away from the surface at that point. And that makes me think that either I'm doing it slightly wrong or it's a really punishing time, you know, management.
Yeah, there are a couple of those. I've got a few frustrations with the game, particularly because it's forced 2D plane. You play on a 2D plane. It interacts at points very, very awkwardly with the 3D environments.
Yeah, because you essentially, it's on a 2D plane, but it never gates off the area with an object that you can push or pull. So you can generally walk in front of the objects that you can push and pull to access different areas by, like, maybe climbing on a box or whatever. But that sometimes means that if you can't quite gauge how deep into the maybe next 2D plane along that that object is, you sometimes can't quite see what objects you can and can't interact with. So I've had a couple of times where I've walked along the screen just to double check that there wasn't anything else that I was supposed to be interacting with, or when I've been stuck for the immediate obvious progression of a puzzle, I've walked along just sort of trying things, assuming that they were close enough for me to have that interaction.
Yeah, I found other parts where it lays out a puzzle, and if the boy could walk away from you by like 2 meters, that's not a puzzle anymore. You could just walk along that plank and then just jump over there and it's fine. And there are a few points of the game, quite a few actually, where, especially with angled platforms, where the platform is angled towards you. And the idea that you can only jump to one particular point on that angled platform, and you can't go towards yourself a little bit to get closer to a jump. Like, there's loads of really awkward stuff like that, the way that the environments are designed. And even, like, there are, not to ruin what happens, but there are points where there are kind of other entities in the world with you that are in, quote-unquote, the background, where you could just go over and you could just walk over up to them.
Yeah.
But instead, and it's just, there are points where it feels so contrived that you're on a 2D plane. And that's one thing you never get with Limbo, because Limbo is a silhouette, and it's very good at saying anything that is a silhouette and is that complete black outline is going to be on your plane. And they use tone or color value to differentiate the depths. And that doesn't exist for this. And that creates a lot of kind of irritating situations, I've found.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say I agree pretty much entirely with everything you've just said.
Hooray! It's good though, I like it. I mean, would you pay, how much is it, 15 quid or something like that? Do you think it's worth it? It's quite short, it's like 3.5 hours, I would say.
Yeah, it's something like that, according to the people that I know who've played it. And so it's a weird one, isn't it? I think I would probably have, if I didn't know how much it was, I'd probably say maybe a tenner. I'd happily pay a tenner. 15 feels ever so slightly more than what it is, but that's an arbitrary.
Yeah, of course,
it feels so arbitrary that I'm saying that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Value's different for everyone, but at the same time, I do feel like it's been very intensely hyped by a lot of like the media, and it's been kind of held up as this great kind of piece of art and a great experiential work. And to an extent, it is. But I came out of it feeling as though I'd not really gotten anything out of it beyond the mood.
Yeah, just being immersed in the mood for a bit. Say, like, I can't assess that because I haven't finished it. I think maybe a third through. Okay. But I would say that so far I haven't had anything that has been sort of absolutely exceptional gaming in terms of It is exceptional, I would say, with the art style and with the ability to create mood and with, you know, these little animation touches and sound touches and things. But overall, as a game experience, I haven't had anything that really pushes it into that absolute top tier of gaming, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. And the ending is kind of something we can talk about maybe on Spoilercast in the future. But and that has its own charms. But yeah, I would agree with that completely, having finished it. Interesting. Mm. Well, we'll talk about it in future once Pippa's finished it, and maybe if you finish it.
I really did appreciate Limbo.
Yeah.
Mm.
Wait, that was part of the golden age of sad boys walking sideways.
Well, the one thing I would say is that in my head, it just is an Xbox game because Limbo was for me and, you know, all of that kind of thing. But that means that I keep mentally referring to it as Inside Xbox, and that's a completely different thing. Yeah. And yeah,
awesome. Chris, what have you been playing?
So I haven't actually played very much in the last week or so because took a break, which is nice. That said, I played quite a bit of Overwatch. However, I did dip my toes, and this is going to be the impressions of a first hour really in Star Citizen again. And this is maybe a weird context for this, but I sort of forgot that I had access to it. And it would be hard to describe a game that is more hypothetically designed exactly for me than Star Citizen, because it is the promise. It is the thing people keep saying they can make, and things fall slightly short of it. The fully persistent MMO spaceship universe where you can get in and out of your ship, where you can be Captain Picard or Han Solo or Captain Reynolds or any other character you want, and just sort of live that fantasy. Which,
who's Captain Reynolds?
Firefly.
Okay.
Sorry. You know, Nathan Fillion.
Well, I just call him Nathan Fillion. Sorry, I'd completely forgotten that he had any other name.
That's subsequently reasonable, but he wasn't that well known when he did Firefly, so he's always Mal to me.
Yeah, but I remember him from other ridiculous things. Anyway.
Anyway. But that fantasy and you know, and so on. And Star Citizen's, obviously, its promises are enormous. The amount of money it raised is enormous. Also, the sort of secrecy it's held under. And obviously the discussion about its payment model and the ships that cost hundreds of dollars and so on. I became a bit, obviously, I think I said on the podcast ages ago, coming up on a year ago, that going to see the film studio where they were, Elstree, where they were doing the motion capture, made me feel like, this is a real project. And it was around that time, I think, that I got access to the game, just the alpha, just to check it out, basically, for my coverage. And at that time, it was the most rudimentary thing that basically the hangars were in, which meant that you had a collection of ships that you bought online. And they sort of gave me access to a bunch of them just so I could see them. And you could walk around a beautifully detailed, appallingly optimized space hangar. And get in and out of the ships and walk around. You couldn't fly anything at that stage. And it felt very tech demo-y. It was like the gulf between, okay, this is beautifully detailed. These ships are extraordinarily designed, but it's a beautiful museum. The gulf between there and this promise of a persistent online world where you can do anything, be anyone, fly anywhere, and land on any planet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the rest of it, was absolutely vast. Like, absolutely vast. And I appreciate it. A couple of years have passed since that sort of thing came out, and the time has snuck up on me, I think. But even so, and even despite, you know, being a lot warmer on the project, and even in some ways reconciling the cost of some of the ships, as somebody who's gotten into more hobby stuff recently, I kind of understand how much money people spend on this stuff and they're really passionate about it. Some of those sort of lingering concerns are still there. So I booted it up again because it's just had some updates, but also it's had its sort of actual MMO element in for a while now, along with the mode where you can just do dogfights and stuff like that in space. It's in the state now that probably Elite Dangerous was during its like first beta, when there was like one space station in one system and a bunch of different things to do and a bit scattered about, but the whole like, you know, procedurally generated Milky Way with billions of systems was distant at that point. Star Citizen is in that place now, I think, and it's shaping up really, really, really well, which is nice to say, because honestly, I think my not cynicism about it, but my kind of circumspection about it was certainly because I want that game to exist so badly that I'm not going to believe it does until it does.
I think as well that spending a bit of time in the industry, when you see people promise this sort of thing, and very frequently it never ever happens. In fact, it always never happens.
Yeah,
pretty much.
I think the other thing is that again, it's another peril of the work that we're in, is that there's a danger that some games, for particular reasons, become divorced from the game that they actually are. They become an ongoing story almost, and Star Citizen was at first just the sheer amount of money that was being pumped into it through crowdfunding drives, but then it became about the conversation that was going on around it by various other people in the industry, and so that those two things together mean that I've focused, or I'd had to focus so much on those ongoing sort of storylines, that the storyline of the game had actually completely been subsumed and drowned out.
Mm-hmm. And this is the thing, I think, for me, and I will tell us a bit more about the game specifically in a second, but for me, this like couple of hours, the hour I put into it now, has been a kind of wake-up call, because I knew, technically, that there is a studio in Frankfurt and a studio in Manchester and a studio in the US, and that hundreds of people who work for Crytek, you know, people with a lot of, you know, background in the industry have been making this thing. It's not a bedroom project. I sort of understood that, but it was sometimes preoccupied by the the discussion around it, and even the sort of top level stuff they keep announcing, the absurd things, like, you know, I went and met Mark Hamill because of this, which is a big moment for me, but like, you know, even then, that's not the game. That's I went to Andy Serkis's motion capture studio and watched, you know, Gimli and Luke Skywalker do space drama. And I just missed out on meeting Gillian Anderson, because she was there the weeks earlier. Like, that's nuts, and it's still not the game, you know? And then the beta game of Weekender earlier in the year, we had some guys come down from Cloud Imperium to show some stuff they were working on, and they came on my live stream to talk about the game. But even then, it wasn't the game. Hmm. It was some nice engineers and designers from a studio. And quietly, it exists, though. And I'm a bit ashamed of myself. I didn't actually just load it. But one of the reasons I didn't, though, and this is worth going into, is it is extraordinarily demanding. Julia, I get that it probably isn't very optimized yet. So my computer at work, which I think has a GTX 980 in it, basically can't run it. On low, it's borderline playable. My old PC couldn't run it. My new PC can run it on very high settings, which wasn't one of the reasons I got a new PC, but it makes me glad that I did.
Yeah.
And I could probably give the specs of this PC to anyone who's interested. Off the top of my head, it's like a Skylake with 16 gig of RAM and a GTX 1080.
Pretty much cutting edge for consumer.
I got it for VR. So, it's like, this is, you know, but that's what you need. And it still takes like 400 years to load.
Right.
You know, like when I started loading it this evening, I was a young man. And now I'm desiccated with age. But anyway, so I tell the story of like what happened loading in, because I loaded in basically no expectations. I'll go for a walk around the hangar again. So I load up my hangar, which is this glittery, beautiful, glittery space place. I place a bookshelf that I can do to decorate my office. Well, I'm like, oh, there's nothing to do. There's no spaceships in it, which is weird. And I couldn't figure out how to get the spaceships. And I find this door. And I completely like bypassed all the options on the main menu that allow you to take a less circuitous route to actually loading the game proper. And I click on the beautiful it's all diegetic UI. It's all like in world or in your helmet or in some, you know, kind of thing around you. Load up the thing and it says I can go to a bunch of different places. So I choose this space station and it takes a million years to load. And then as I load in, like my character is climbing out of a bunk with a little blanket in a little space apartment. And I can hear like noises and there's tannoy for the space station and so on. And the chat window pops up and I'm in multiplayer and I can see other players typing in the box. Some of them are role playing and stuff like that. And there's a sink and there's stuff on the floor and there's postcards and it's mega, mega detailed like I showed you earlier, Tom.
Yeah.
And those rooms are all different as well, which is fucking nuts.
Oh, well.
I go over to the little wardrobe and I press use and my character like opens the door and then I put my space suit on, see the helmet. And then I go for a walk around the station and I get to this control room with a big holographic planet thing, and there's a lot of the players around and there's like these little panels, and I go and click on one of the panels and lets me choose my ship, and it still has, I think, the stuff that was registered on my profile when I just was, you know, given stuff to look at in the hangar.
Yeah.
So as far as I can tell, it's a complete list of the ships that are in the game. So it might, like, I, you know, I wasn't one of the people who were lucky enough to ever get a Steam press account, but this is probably the most valuable thing I own. Yeah. Now.
Tens of thousands of dollars of...
And so, but I was still thinking like it was the elite thing of like you load into your ship and you fly off and you don't necessarily interact with the players. Because in Elite, which I played a lot of, you don't really interact with a lot of other players. It'll happen sometimes. But they don't see you walking around because you can't walk around. You know, you're a ship or you're just in a menu, basically. And so I pick up the ship and it says, oh, it's parked outside. And I picked what I knew to be the most expensive ship, which is this thing called the Constellation Andromeda, which is like it's sort of, I guess, I'm trying to think of a good scale. Like sort of Millennium Falcon Serenity size, maybe bigger, multi-crew ship, lots of different crew stations, multiple rooms. It has a fighter docked in it that can't launch out of it yet, but you can sit in the cockpit, which is pretty rad.
Oh, yeah.
Like turret stations and stuff.
Hmm.
And so I get this thing and then it's like, oh, it's outside. And I was like, okay. So I follow the, literally it says, you know, I don't, landing pad A10 or something. So I follow the signs, like I'm in an airport to find landing pad A10. I have to go out through an airlock, which involves depressurizing the airlock and actually going outside and, you know, mask steams up when you do that or frosts over or whatever. And it's all very, very immersive. And I go outside and huge rotating space station above you, like massive thing and a huge planet. And it's just sort of seamless with open space. And there's my huge ship just like parked on the landing pad. And there are other players around like moving their ships and stuff. And someone in the chat is like, sees me running up to this thing and goes like, hey, is that yours? And I'm like, I don't say anything because I'm like panicked. And I'm like looking at it, trying to find the button to lower the landing ramp. And I'm running around it, and he's running after me, like, "Can I come on board? Can I have a look? Can I come?" Because it's like I've got like a much better car, space car than him, or like, you know what I mean? Like, and I don't deserve this. I've never.
Is it like when someone comes up to you and wants to know about the customizations when you're in the McDonald's car park and you've got like a nice boy racer car? I'm not gonna go any further with that because you're just both looking at me like, what kind of
basically? But like, and I didn't realize that what I had done was basically deploy this vast show of wealth.
Yeah.
Into the game.
Nice.
And I felt, oh God, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? And so I get the lift down, and then I managed to like jump on and like scoop the lift back up before the guy can get on. Because I'm like, no. I didn't want to disappoint him or blow him up by accident because I've never even flown a ship before. But I'm really self-conscious. Like, I don't want to quit because like, I don't want to like be obviously like I was bothered. But I also like it's like play act cool, and so I like run to the ship, and then I'm like obviously like the inside is really awesome, but I had seen the inside before when I had the hangar thing, and I run to the pilot seat and sit down, and the fucking UI work they've done is just tip top. Like the different ships have different holographic UIs based on the manufacturer of the ship, and it's all in the world and it's beautiful. It makes me want to cry. Like, and this thing loads up, and I'm like, okay, I'm using a mouse and keyboard. Wazzed, let's go. And so what you should do is hold space to use your vertical thrusters to lift up a bit. It does a lot more automatically for you than Elite does in that regard, but not if you just press forwards.
Right.
So I just go forwards, and obviously it's space, so the throttle goes up, and I just start moving. And someone else's ship, maybe the guy who wanted a lift, is like parked on the landing pad in front of mine.
No,
and I can't stop.
I can't,
and
I'm in hear the... this. No, no, no.
And the giant expensive space bus just like rolls out. And I like try and pull up, but there's quite a lot of inertia and I kind of misjudge it. And I have to like roll my ship in order to only like bounce off his and then like do a flip and then like crash off the pad sideways. At which point I start to hear lasers. And like I hear like the ship, all the ships have different voices as well. They've got voice actors to do the different computers for different manufacturers' ships. Wow. And it goes like, you know, rear shield, and all the proximity like collision alerts are going off. Like collision alert front, collision alert top, collision alert bottom. And I like bounce off the pad, and this ramming someone else's ship by accident has attracted station security. So this thing's attacking me, and I'm just like, I managed to like. Careen out of the space station, like tumble through space for a bit, get control of it, point it away from the space station, and just like find the button for like, you know, sublight engine boost thingy, just rocketing away. I stop getting chased and my shield regenerates, and I'm just like, I've just got to go. Bring up the options menu, find the key bindings list, and it's like, find the hyperdrive button.
Yeah.
I can't work out how that works. Pick any point. And I mean, I showed you this before we started recording. It has a beautiful, completely seamless, like, hyperdrive thing.
It's real good.
It's like the kind of the world kind of like folds like the inside of a bubble and sort of like you shot into it. It's hot.
Good shit.
And then I sort of like exited like hyperspace, just in this empty aerospace. I'm like, oh, thank God. But I can still see the chat from the space station. And like, I don't think people realized what would happen, but someone was like, I think they call them Connies, the constellations. Like, did anyone just see that Connie, like, get chased out of the station by security? What the hell was that? And I was like, no one saw anything. Seamless.
I love the way that, first of all, you denied a prol. I've watched you get into that ship, and there's literally a ladder that drops down, and you must have literally pulled up
ship.
The ladder.
It was, the one you saw was, I'll show you after we've recorded.
Oh, yeah.
It's much bigger.
Oh, my.
And it has a lift that goes, I got onto the lift and went up into the
denied.
Ship. Yeah. I think I would have invited him on, but I didn't know how to fly it, and I didn't want him to know that I didn't know how to fly it.
But that was soon evident.
Yeah, exactly.
Based on what happened next. He had to stand on the platform and watch you, your calamitous escape.
It's like, sorry, I'm too drunk to drive.
It just looks like you not only didn't want him to come into your space house, you then rammed his space caravan just because you could, and then you ran away.
Goodbye, proles.
You just, you're like the worst kind of dickhead. And I feel really, really sad for that person.
No.
I did abandon him at the service station in space.
I really, he or she is just sad now.
I think they'll get over it. But yeah, and then, so I went for a walk around the...
Does that kill their ship? Will they be able to? Like,
I don't think so.
There is real time ship damage, but I don't know if it applies.
I don't think it's in the alpha. I don't think it's in the alpha either.
Okay, like because you know, what if they sort of saved up?
It wasn't the introduction to my new life in space that I was hoping for. All right. But it happened, and I can't unhappen it.
It's like if you bought the shard in London, and then someone asked you to come in, and you said no, and then the shard fell over onto their house.
It's exactly the equivalent. No, it's if I was given the shard without
without deserving it. No merits.
And then I dropped it on someone. Nice. Hopefully it wasn't his car. It was literally that feeling of like, actually, so I don't have a driving license in real life. And it's mostly for reasons like this. And I failed my driving test like 4 times when I was 17 and have never done it again. But I still sometimes have like recurring driving stress nightmares because I hated driving. Like I really hated it.
I love it.
Because I just like I can do space games. I can do flying, but I'm specifically absent-minded in a way that makes me bad at cars. I think. Like I once just drove over a verge for no reason.
Oh God!
Like with my driving instructor, just kind of wasn't paying attention. So what am I going over here now?
Oh my god!
Really awful.
So if you can't handle the 2D plane, but a 3D plane, you can do that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I could figure out, like, you know, also, a dogfighting is a lot about, like, trying to converge with another object to kill it, which you don't do.
You don't do that with cubs. No,
yeah, exactly. whereas I can converge with the verge in order to kill it.
Nice.
Oh,
That moment of like I can't slow down, I can't stop, and there's someone parked in front of me was like a driving stress dream. Although I was driving like a fucking 18 wheelie. I mean, it has the compensatory power of 18 wheelies.
Can I just say that listening to this story, though, it sounds like you're one of those dreadful My Super Sweet 16 recipients of a car that's too powerful for it that they haven't earned, like you said, and then promptly drives it into one of the people that they've paid to attend their birthday party.
Yeah, all of these analogies are 100% on point. Anyway, so I got to this empty sector of space, went for a walk around my ship, accidentally fell through the floor, and then while trying to jet around in space with my little exosuit boosters, ran myself over and died.
Brian Harvey, let that be a lesson to you.
Mm.
He ran himself over with his own car and blamed eating a baked potato, I believe.
I've run myself over with motorbikes twice. That's a Chris fact.
Were baked potatoes involved?
It's just incompetence.
Okay.
It's actually quite hard to do, running yourself over. It's possible.
Did you do it in Star Citizen? Yes, you
did. I did do it in Star Citizen.
Yeah.
What was it that prompted you to pick up Star Citizen again? What reminded you that it...
Work things.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so after that, I decided that I had to use the simulator to like learn how to do the flying, and I played the dogfighting mode, which is just like wave. You can do it multiplayer or like wave survival against these like alien fighters, and you can play most of the ships you own. So I took like a space combat, you know, a fighter up, like a heavy multi-purpose fighter, and I really, really liked it. So that's the other thing I want. So aside from, you know, MMO shenanigans, which do bode well for the game because there's a bunch of stuff in there. There's a rudimentary quest system. It's still very, very early, though. There's also this sort of the dogfighting side to it. And it works really nicely. Like, it's a very different game to Elite in terms of the things you've got to think about. It's a much more traditional dogfighting game, I think, in some ways. Although I haven't played enough of it to become anywhere near expert at it. But the thing I really, really, really like about it, that really sort of sold it to me, is the dynamic damage. So ships don't just have like a health bar and then they pop. In fact, you don't really see very much, as far as I can tell, of your opponent's health, which is realistic.
Yeah.
You see their shields flare up if they've still got shields when you shoot at them. Otherwise, you do get an indicator, at least in this mode, that you're getting points for doing damage. But like the alien ships are like, they're called scythes, and they're scythe-shaped, appropriately enough. Like, they're sort of like the curve of a scythe is the sort of outside of the wing. And if you, like, you know, barrel down towards them and unload with all your guns and then have shields, you can cut the wing off with bullets and it falls off, and all that stuff, as far as I can tell, is either dynamic or it's detailed enough to look like I shot that specific panel off. And that feels really, really good, like when you send someone spiraling out of control and they explode. Awesome. even like I had this, I had a bad convergence with one of them, really close range. They kind of bank as they're coming in and slice past me.
Hmm.
And suddenly my left hand gun stopped working. And I realized they'd been sliced off my own ship. Like them crashing into me, I survived it. But they like sheared straight through my left wing. Oh, and wow. So those guns just aren't there anymore.
It's kind of a simulation.
Yeah, it's really good. Like, again, super early. I played one 20-minute session of just flying around trying to shoot things and trying to learn never to shame myself again. But it's boding really well. And it's really nice to see it shape up because it's so stupidly ambitious. And the fact that it's also going to be an FPS and a trading game. And
yeah.
You're going to be able to go explore the galaxy and drive little buggies around and all this stuff is crazy. But the fact that it exists as a game that you can play, at least to the extent that it does now, given the precedent of games like Elite that have grown from a similar kind of little basic nugget vertical slice of game into a big thing, gives me some hope that it'll happen. And maybe it won't be the thing they promised for another 10 years, God knows, given how, you know, how ambitious it is. But I feel much more confident saying it's something worth being excited about, or at very least that something like Squadron 42, which is the single player module, is worth being excited about, because it turns out those multiple studios full of people are clearly making something, and it is very, very, very impressive. Like, it'll end up being an amazing VR demo, if nothing else.
Right.
Like, even if the baseline game doesn't end. Because if you like the idea of sitting down in a spaceship seat and a big holographic interface goes zoop, doop, doop, boop, boop, in front of you, and then a robot goes, docking clamp released, then you'll like this game.
Marvellous.
That's a Chris recommendation.
But what do you actually have to buy to play it now?
I think, I don't know, because it's I don't really deserve any of this.
Hmm.
I think there's like a starter pack which comes with some ships, or you can buy a ship. And I don't know if buying a ship is enough to get you access.
Yeah.
Because you think it would make sense. Like, if you're going to pay $350 for a ship,
probably get the game with it.
Probably get the game with it.
We'll look into it though.
But I don't know. I'll maybe put some information in the show notes or something. Because with that heavy fucking caveat, I don't know if I would recommend this to somebody to actually invest in at this stage.
Sure.
Because, like, I have had the opportunity to poodle around in it without any investment of my own, so of course I'm going to like it. But it is glitchy and it is buggy and it does run terribly on any PC I can find except the one I just spent a lot of money on.
Right.
So, you know, there's lots of good reasons to be circumspect about it, at least for a while. But there's also good reasons to be potentially a bit more excited about it, or if you have already invested, to feel a bit better about that investment, because there clearly are, you know.
Do you think it'll start popping up at places like Eurogamer Expo or, you know, anything like that? Like, is it in a fit state to be shown off in that way, do you think?
Couldn't say.
Okay. Well, good.
Should we do questions from questions?
Okay.
I don't care.
Now, Pip, don't be like that. Let's answer some lovely questions sent to us by the internet.
I'm only put out because my owl impression was being laughed at in the break.
The internet doesn't know or care about your bad owl impression.
Anyway, questions, was it?
Questions it is. The wonderfully named De Beep Beep writes, which PC game would you recommend to somebody who loved Advance Wars, particularly Dark Conflict, i.e. with unit level ups? He's referring to the, I believe, Game Boy Advance strategy series.
Yes.
Which is very well loved.
Turn-based, grid-based strategy game where you control lots of tanks and heroes with cool abilities. Not familiar with Dark Conflict, but your best bet is anything that resembles a tactics game. And there aren't many of these on PC, unfortunately. Like, if you can find Final Fantasy Tactics and things like that, Ogre Tactics might be one that is also worth checking out. Also, probably not on PC. The only one that springs to mind for me is Disgaea or Disgaea. And
Disgaea,
something like that. That's definitely on PC because I was playing it this week. And that is insane if you want to level up individual people and even their items. And in fact, you can dive into your items to level them up. And Alex Wiltshire was talking about this game last week on the podcast, which is why I started playing it. And it is every bit as nuts and in depth as he described. So sweet. That is definitely one to check out if you like characters on grids doing turn-based combat.
And micromanagement.
Yep, lots of lovely micromanagement and weird chain bonuses with gems and just play it. It sounds like it'll serve you well.
What's Valkyria Chronicles, and does it fit in this category?
Valkyria Chronicles is more of a traditional JRPG, except it's set in a sort of
Japanese fantasy Belgium.
Yes, and almost on like I want to say First World War, but on the cusp of mechanized warfare in that universe. And it's kind of a real time pause deal,
right?
In third person, and I've not played it very much, as you can tell. But it's not quite.
I saw a tank thing. That has a dog in it.
Yeah, that could be a thing. Wouldn't be out of place in that world.
You could just be naming things you thought about this afternoon, though.
I might be getting confused with Call of Duty Ghosts, which definitely does have a tank with a dog in it.
Valkyria Chronicles is supposed to be amazing. I really need to play it, but I just don't have
it. Just came to mind because it was from a... I'd just think about a tank with a dog in it, to be honest.
I wonder why tactics games didn't really come to PC, like why that genre isn't...
A good question. I think it was so associated with mobile that people assume that perhaps there's no audience for it on PC. But I would say there absolutely is. If you look at almost everything that's been ported over from Japan, including shmups and arcade shmups and stuff like that, they've all found an audience on PC, and beat 'em ups as well. And if the porting cost isn't that expensive, then it's
Is it worth maybe considering that like Japanese games didn't necessarily come over to PC very much?
Mm.
For a long time. They do now, but like there wasn't necessarily like, you know, those games would come over to console, but they wouldn't necessarily come over to PC at all until recently. Like finding that now with like most of the Final Fantasy back catalogue just arriving on PC one after another, and they could have been on PC years ago.
Absolutely.
Outside of emulators.
And surprise, surprise, they've done really well. And Valkyria Chronicles did incredibly well on PC. It was a decent enough port. But there's absolutely an appetite for it. I think it's just taken a publisher. I mean, say like Sega and I think
Squeenix,
and people have just picked up a load of IPs from Japan and actually said, actually, let's just port these and see what happens. And it sounds like it's been a success for them. And maybe IPs generated in Japan for Japanese audiences won't have necessarily gone, because the PC isn't big at all in Japan. It seems like it's even Xbox struggles. It seems like it's a handheld platforms are huge there, but desktop PCs, not so much at all. So publishers might not necessarily recognise that there's a market for that.
Mm.
Want to see more, though?
Mm-hmm. Enjoy that, Disgaea. Andrew writes, yo's to the crows. He can say that because he's American.
But you lost a little in translation, perhaps.
I know. It's Andrew, who emailed about heists and surprises a few weeks ago. While I find your discussion of the question in my game design issue both enlightening and entertaining, I'm still curious to hear your thoughts about amnesia and other in media res in video games. Are there any games that you think handle it more gracefully than others? Are there any that stand out as ham-fisted mess? Glad you like the aquarium. If I lived in town, I'd go off to work every day just to sit in the front of the big tank.
Correct.
That's a tank that doesn't have a dog in it.
No.
It has several whale sharks.
You can get scuba suits for pets, though.
Can you?
I believe so. Yeah, I've seen them on the internet.
Have you ever tried to get a wet dog into a towel?
But it wouldn't be wet, because it would be wearing a scuba suit.
Have you ever tried to get a dry dog into clothes?
Well, presumably you'd, like, rear them to be into clothes. Because this is the problem that I had with my cat, which is that it was really resistant to its Santa outfit. And I figure that...
That is a malfunction on the part of the cat.
I should have started earlier. No, I'm blaming myself. Mm. Like, I should have acclimatized him to his expected Christmas duties from an early age. Like, I learned what was expected of me culturally at Christmas from when I was a child.
Stupid cat.
So I feel like Fudgy could have fucking stepped up.
That's only reasonable, but it's also a tangent.
This is how we end up not answering amnesia questions.
Yeah, exactly. Andrew, I'm sorry. We're not deliberately avoiding or ironically forgetting the time you asked that question. Amnesia is such a hoary old cliche at this point that it's quite tricky. I would say that the first Knights of the Old Republic game, and actually parts of the second, both have good amnesia kind of plot lines in it. Like, it is an RPG where you... And the reason it works, and I'm going to spoil a, like, 14-year-old RPG, so spoilers for Knights of the Republic who haven't played it. The reason it works so well is because your character doesn't know they have amnesia. It isn't you wake up one day and you don't know who you are. You think you know who you are, and it's only halfway through the game that you find out that you've had all these memories implanted in you, and you're actually somebody else. And it works spectacularly well as a twist for that reason, and you see echoes of it. And they managed to do it in such a way that the fact that you're actually not who you remember yourself being is the simpler explanation. You know, it is the simpler explanation for things that are happening to you than trying to reconcile who you think you are and the Jedi powers you have and the things you're connected to and the things that keep happening to you.
But how does it start then? Like, because presumably it still has to go through tutorials with you and it still has to go through character setup. So, like, if the character doesn't know they have amnesia, how did they deal with that part of it?
So, at the opening of the game, you wake up from, like, I think a dream even, which may or may not be actually a memory. And then you're in a ship and you're like a member of the crew, like a regular member of the crew on this. And this warship that's under attack, and someone runs into the room and, like, you know, tells you to get on your feet, and then you do the combat tutorial and stuff. And as things calm down, the person asks you, like, so who are you anyway? And you can say, oh, I'm a smuggler and I was brought on board to do this. Or I'm a member of the Republic military and I'm doing this. And you, for all intents and purposes, you pick that as a player and your character means it. Like, but that is you picking the memory you were implanted with, which you find out later on. So I think that's a good way of doing, like, faulty recollection.
Can't think of any others.
Because most of the rest do, like, you don't remember who you are.
Yeah, which makes... God, The Witcher 2 is a terrible example where the plot just makes so little sense because Geralt doesn't
Geralt has amnesia at the start of Witcher 1 as well.
Does he?
Yeah.
Poor man.
Because the first scene in Witcher 1 is Geralt in a wheelbarrow being dragged back to Kaer Morhen with amnesia.
Yeah.
And he only remembers when he kills a great big... praying mantis and shag somebody.
He's like, wait a minute.
this is who I am.
Oh, excellent. My God.
No, it's mostly awful.
Yeah, my thing is more that I remember, or I appreciate the games that find a different way of doing it, because at this point it feels like it's not even a thing that you can do well or badly. It's the lazy option. And so to sort of excel, it sort of... people do something different, I guess. Like, I quite like how Fallout handled it with, you know, because I've only really played Fallout 3 and half of New Vegas. But, you know, the idea of you going through basic milestones and sort of getting to grips with the world as different life stages of person, I guess. And then you have your sort of end of year, you know, like your GCSEs almost, and you find out, like, more about your it's goats, isn't it? And then you find out, like, your personality score off the back of that and stuff. And I think that that's kind of interesting and different. And obviously it's, you know, again, it's not an amnesia example, but the reason that I was interested in it in the first place was that it wasn't amnesia. And, and I'm really not coming up with anything that treats that stuff as interesting.
It's such a tricky situation. So the other game actually that occurred to me that I think does do it well is the first Bioshock, which again makes the fact that you don't remember things properly a key part of the plot, in a way where I think it's similar to the reveal in Knights of the Republic. It's a similar thing where as you encounter more story beats, you being who you think you are becomes more and more absurd, if you know what I mean. So in Knights of the Republic, that's, if I'm just some Republic nobody, how am I this powerful in the Force? And why is everyone so worried about me being powerful in the Force? Like, why is everyone being a dick about it? Almost as if they did this to me and they're worried that I'm remembering. Like, and that's, and, you know, like, it feeds into the relationships around you. Like, in Knights of the Old Republic, like, you, one of the main sort of romance tracks and one of your earliest companions and a character that has the most complicated relationship with you
it will later turn out, is the person who put those memory blocks on you, who can't leave you alone because she's worried about what will happen if she does, but that is a fucked situation in which to meet somebody.
It also, it creates a, feeds into the most interesting dilemma of that game, is it's almost like a nature-nurture thing. It's that idea of, what if you had to start again? Is it it's fate versus individual choice, and would you go down this good route instead? And that's a really interesting, dramatic question.
And this, the other brilliant thing about it is it frames good and evil, light side and the dark side in that game, in a really
complicated
in a really complicated way. Because if you go to the dark side, when you find out who you really are, you are in a way you're actually partly maybe reclaiming who you actually are, but also you are throwing off the shackles that were put on you by people who, against your will, imprisoned you, took away your memories.
Did a very bad thing to you. And you're justified in revenge.
You're getting your revenge.
Yeah.
Or if you stay with the light, you're ultimately doing more to protect people and to forgive people and so on. But you're also basically like accepting a punishment that maybe was crazily severe. Like,
yeah.
It's really coming and really interesting. And it all hinges off that idea of not remembering and discovering rather than knowing from the start who you are. Similarly, Bioshock, like as you go on, the little details like, oh, you know, only Andrew Ryan can use the Vita chambers. Like, there's little details in the story, and the fact that you just happen to plane crash here and all this stuff's happening. Like, when that story does its little series of reveals, the whole idea that you were just flying home to the farm becomes increasingly absurd. Until the point where the amnesia reveal is actually, like, almost like Occam's razor. It's like, actually, it makes more sense that you are from here. The one that I don't think does work, and I know we're kind of, it's impossible to talk about this without driving the spoiler bus around, so, is Bioshock Infinite.
Right.
And I think because it actually attempts something very, very similar to Bioshock, because it wants to do that, you know, there's always a man, there's always a lighthouse, there's always a big diving suit for some reason, there's always, like, another man who's actually the same man, but what if? And there's always, like, a book of philosophy that's been turned into a city. The notion in that, well, okay, Bioshock Infinite spoilers, but that game is, what, 4 years old now? 5 years old?
Don't say things like that. Let's not say things like that.
No, it's like 3 years old, surely. Four.
Maybe three and a half.
Yeah.
Three and a half.
is that you are actually this... So in Bioshock, in the first one, you find out that you are actually like either son of or a clone of a character that you've been hearing but not seeing, and you don't know what you look like. So it's kind of understandable that you would go through that whole thing without realizing that's who you are, because also it's a crazy leap of logic to make. In Bioshock Infinite, you turn out to be a character that you have met multiple times in different contexts, who doesn't look like you, appears to be much older than you, who doesn't sound like you.
Yeah.
And who has an enormous bushy beard.
Lovely beard.
And the beard is clearly there to kind of maybe even hedge the fact that they have to make it look sufficiently not like you. But it seems really unlikely that if you shaved him, you would get you.
They should have done the old glasses and fake nose kind of setup, really.
The reveal in Infinite should have been exactly the situation in Bioshock where Andrew Ryan gives you the golf club and says, like, do it then, you know, and then you beat him to death with the golf club. But it should have been, like, Comstock, like, in front of you, like, I don't know, restrained.
Shave me.
And he hands you a razor. Shave me, Booker. Shave me.
That would be amazing.
And,
as
you shave him by, like, just gently massaging the right analog stick to, like, get some mousse on the badger hair brush. you reveal your own face.
He's like, no.
You could drag him over to the barbershop quartet. Exactly. Still, like,
well,
singing.
An actual barbershop quartet sings.
God only knows.
Sings God only knows or something.
What he'd be without that beard.
Yeah, exactly. But, God only knows what I'd be without beard.
But just while I think of it, Cradle does interesting things with amnesia.
Sorry.
Like, just while I have it in my head. And that's such a weird game, and it's so beautiful, and it has, like, one of the best skies that I've seen in a game in a very long time. And a lot of it doesn't quite come together, and it's such an acquired taste, and it's this sort of weird transhumanist yurt-based point and click in the future with a weird block mini game every now and again. But it does, Amnesia is actually a key part of that story, and it fitted a lot better than other stories. It was still, you know, the catalyst for you going off and doing things and finding stuff out, but it was I was a lot happier with its presence there. But just while I'm also sort of have those in my head, there are other games that do more interesting things with memory, I'd say, and or incorporate memory gaining and losing better. Like, I'd say that Life is Strange does some nice, just little mechanical things with memory because of how you can rewind time and you learn things.
Yeah.
What else? Oxenfree has, I think, a new game plus mode which feeds on the decisions you make in your original run, I think, if I'm right. And also, I think it's called Fingered, which I think is by the Super Meat Boy guy,
Edmund McMillan.
And it's about sort of witness memory issues, because I think you have a sort of basic description of a person and you have to pick them out of a lineup, but it's you know, it's that kind of like it's funny and it's, you know, there's a memory aspect to that which is interesting. And I know that wasn't the Amnesia point, but I think that for my money that memory stuff is often better utilized in other ways than Amnesia. Like, I struggle so much trying to think of anything that was better than just blah.
Tell you what, game that would actually be better with an Amnesia plot is Fallout 4. Hear me out. So that game's problem for me.
I wasn't not hearing you. And I was just doing
I was being emphatic. I wasn't accusing you. And now I've lost my thread.
I'm hearing you out.
Okay. My problem with that game, and the reason I bounced off it, I think, is because it does the opposite of Amnesia. The opposite of Amnesia is remembering. It doesn't remember. It allows you to play like a little bit of your life before the apocalypse, where you meet your spouse, either husband or wife, and son. And then you all run to the vault and you get frozen and bad things happen. You got to run around shouting, "Where's my son?" for a long time. But the big problem with this is it's at total odds with the type of game Fallout is, because Fallout is a game where you go off in the world and you kind of define who you are and you make your own relationships and stuff. And there are romance plots in that game. And maybe we've talked about this in the pod before, but there's romance plots with a cool robot detective. And that's great. That should absolutely be in the game. You know, there's romance options of every of the sort of sexualities and so on. You can have same sex relationship, but all of that is undermined by the fact that the beginning of the game places you in an explicitly heteronormative relationship with a child. And also the timescale of the game means that by the time you meet, like,
a child as an addition,
as in you have an important comma. Yeah.
This is why commas are important, kids. There's a comma in that sentence. Was there a comma in that sentence? Yes. Maybe even two. It's actually pretty poorly punctuated, but the point is, not disgusting. By the time of the timescale of the game, so I felt like I'd been out of the vault for about 3 days. My wife is dead, and I'm being asked to make decisions about whether or not I like the cool robot detective or the spunky reporter. Which one of them do I want to get with on the romance track? It's like, really, the only answer if you care about the integrity of the fiction is neither of them, because in my experience, I lost my wife and child literally 3 days ago. And, like, so what I was going to say is, that's a game where if the game started with you waking up from cryostasis without your memory, and in front of you is the frozen but shot corpse of a woman with her wedding ring on, and somehow like that ties into the main quest, but you only find out later in the game that she was your wife,
right,
and yeah. you've forgotten, then that would actually make the fact that you can subsequently establish yeah, relationships kind of interesting.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you go like, oh, I don't remember who I was. And like that would be, you know, I'm not saying that would change your sexuality or solve that problem, but it would at least give you a reason to go like, oh, well, I shacked up with this person and now I'm discovering that I was married and I surely have some obligations there, or I'm related to this character and I didn't realize it. Which I know is an old cliche, but if that would at least preserve the player's agency a bit compared to, here's your wife, here's your child. They're dead now, aren't you sad? But wouldn't you like to shag this robot?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest problem, is that games do this a lot, where they expect you to be invested by in personal relationships you supposedly have in first person with these people without ever telling you anything about them. They introduce you to you as roles, just archetypes. It's like,
hello, I fulfill the role of husband.
Welcome to your wife archetype, and here is your child archetype, and they expect you to have some sort of emotional connection to it. And that's putting far too much faith in humanity to expect people to form a kind of any kind of emotional bond with someone based on that limited level of interaction.
Widespread pop cultural thing,
though. Absolutely, it's like true.
A man shouting, where's my daughter / dog / son / wife? Is the cornerstone for people diving sideways, shooting guns out of cars.
Absolutely. And when you're watching Taken, that's fine, because you're watching Liam Neeson, who is not you, doing the mad shit on a boat with the guns.
So you presume that he's had at least 5 minutes to form a bond with these people outside the confines of the movie.
Yeah.
By the time the action starts, they've probably spent a bit of time in each other's company.
And you might be able to buy into his motivations, but if they're supposed to be your personal motivations, that's not going to happen with a 10-minute intro sequence.
That's the thing, is you either ignore it completely and go off and do your own thing, in which case you might as well never have done it in the first place, or the player engages in a kind of like madly committed act of role play where they go, okay, I'm in. I've just undergone this terrible, terrible tragedy. I'm a sad person. Anyway, now I'm going to dress myself in bottle caps and romance a detective.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm going to pick some plants. Lots of plants.
Yeah. The one thing
Found a town out of grief and make a big sign in the shape of a dick.
One thing that I'll say before we move on is that I was not a big fan of this game in any way, shape or form. But I'll mention Unravel and mild spoilers, I guess. So if you want to go into it, they are spoilers. So if you maybe skip on a minute, but it's not amnesia, but one of the ways of reading the way that you are reconstructing a scrapbook over the course of the game is that it's about memory loss and dementia and rebuilding those moments through this like magical little creature. And so I really did not get on with that game, but I know that a few people found it moving and sort of found that effective and affecting. So that's another one to maybe add on the list to check out in terms of things that some people have reacted well to in terms of memory loss. And it's not you, the protagonist, but it's kind of an integral part of the game if you take that reading of it.
I think we've answered Andrew's question about amnesia. Daniel writes, hi, Cinders and Rumbars. After hearing Pip's comments on Tilt Brush and the comments on mime training, I felt you might be interested in my experience. I've been a sign language interpreter for a couple of years and often visualize signs in a manner similar to sweeping brush strokes in Tilt Brush. After finally getting a turn, I chose to draw a vista from the Good Spider-Man movie, with Spidey swinging through a city in full 3D with the scene making sense from most angles.
Which one is the Good Spider-Man? This is how we end up
the second one.
Sorry. Yes. Oh, fine.
It's basically the first one again, but better.
Is it still Tobey Maguire, though?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not interested. Anyway, okay. What's the rest of the...
It was an earlier period. It was a more innocent age, but we accepted Tobey Maguire then. We didn't know. He says, after finishing my artwork to a satisfactory level, I teleported and looked at the other charades
To my surprise, all of my friends had treated Tiltbrush like a paintbrush and painted on a 2D plane. I had found myself instinctively painting in 3D with sweeping scene. I wonder if I have a more developed sense of 3D projection, I think he means, and how this translates to VR. Thoughts? Alternatively, when did you discover that your friends were shit at VR?
I think that's a really interesting point, and I wouldn't be surprised if it is a kind of, not exactly a muscle memory thing, but I think that generally people's art education is very much, or at least in my experience, limited to two-dimensional stuff. Like, at school, it was so rare that we ever got to do anything involving clay or anything involving actual sort of three-dimensional stuff, because it was obviously took up more space, it was harder to transport, it was, you know, a bit of a pain really, and so we mostly had, you know, drawing and painting and all manner of similar things, and so it really wouldn't surprise me if most people just were used to their hand stopping in that moment. And I think as well, it's still not massively instinct to walk around the 3D space. Like, I think it's very easy to get stuck in one position, and even when you're being taught drawing, you know, the repeated advice, because people find it so difficult to break the habit of, is to move around more and to sort of use your entire arm instead of just your, you know, your wrist and your hand. And so I think if you are far more comfortable with sort of that process of moving your hands through 3D space and tracing out shapes, and if you are actively visualizing it that way as well, then I it wouldn't surprise me if that was massively helpful to this process.
Tiltbrush is the best VR thing.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
My favorite thing.
Proper kind of little bit of a... like a rush, not an ego rush, almost like a godlike sense of, I'm going to create this 3D thing out of nothing, and it's a wonderful feeling. First things I did was created a portal, like a head shaped portal, and then blocked off the view, and then tried to create a vista that you can only see by sticking your head through it.
Oh, that's so cool!
And try and just create like trees on the other side. For some reason, like trees are just the first thing I did was actually make a tree out of light.
Yeah.
Because I think the coiling and branches and the way that you can just rotate around it and enjoy that as a 3D experience is just instinctive.
Oh, do you know what I now want to do? Is I want to... did you ever see... There's an artist whose work was very much sort of about climbing up ladders and then poking your head into like a fake attic space, or, you know, bending over and sticking your head into a crate and the artwork would actually be inside, but absolutely, you'd have to physically maneuver yourself into the position where you could see it. And I'm wondering whether I could do that on such a tiny budget, but in, you know, that tiny sort of 2 meter by 3 meter space, and just create like a little landscape and then just box it off entirely so that somebody would have to actually stick their head into the thing, because that would be amazing to upload and just see whether people actually did it, you know, whether they thought that it was just a black box or remembered that you can actually move through that space. That's
whether they would obey the kind of legitimacy of the opaque surfaces that you're going to build around these environments. But that was really interesting to me as well, because when you do that, when I created this portal, I kind of boxed it out, I tried to create a miniature garden, like a tiny garden. You can get your brush really small.
Yeah.
And there's a really interesting effect of like miniaturization in a virtual 3D environment. And it doesn't still feel miniature. It feels really big when your head is close to it in a way that... Because you don't have the same understanding of relative size in virtuality as you do in real life. So it feels like sticking your head in a box with lots of tiny, quite intricate things, they suddenly seem much larger than they are. And it was just so fascinating to play with those ideas. I think it's just it's one of the best things VR has done for me. I don't want to experience other people's dungeons with skeletons in. I could just make my own fucking crazy stuff and experiments. It's great.
The Vive that I have at the moment access to, one of the base stations is misfiring, so I can't get that fine control. Right. So I was trying to add little things to the forest scene that I was trying to create, like, you know, maybe mushrooms or like little bugs or, you know, things like that. And it just, I couldn't do it because I couldn't maintain the control without the, like, the tracking wigging out totally. So that might need to wait until I can borrow the one that actually works. But yeah, like, that's something that I'd actually be super interested in pursuing. So yeah.
It's really cool. Really cool thing.
Yeah.
Finally, Dan writes, "Dear Cajun and Creole, I like the use of food in Shadowrun Returns Dragonfall Hong Kong. Soy burgers are washed down with cups of soy calf or made by your megacorp overlords, while real Turkish coffee and zebra meat can be obtained with the right connection, right connections and enough nuyen. The combination of these reflects a dystopian future setting where Shadowrunners and fixes can get you anything for a price. What are some other good examples of in-game cuisine being tailored to contribute to a game's theme and setting?" Dan.
The one that instantly springs to my mind is the whale paraphernalia in Dishonored. But that's, I think, because it comes up in so many discussions of things, you know, sort of people talking about, like, you know, chowing down on their jellied whatnots in Dishonored. But I, you know, with the amount of like whale oil and whale meat and all of that kind of stuff, it did make me wonder if there was like some secret plague of whales that just really wasn't being talked about. Like they've like infested an alternate reality and sort of, you know, just sodded off and are just having a brilliant time out there, a whale of a time, if you will. Say. But like, is there anything in the lore, you'll probably know this, absolutely, Chris, about like, are there just whales everywhere?
No, the whales are like being hunted to extinction.
Oh.
Which is, but they're also probably where magic comes from. Because all the bone charms are whale bone. Like, whales are everywhere in that game. Have you finished Dishonored?
Yeah.
You know the Granny Rags encounter?
No. I don't. You know what my memory's
you
like.
You fight Susan Sarandon in a big furnace inside the hollowed out skeleton of a whale.
No.
Okay, that happens.
Are you sure? I feel like that's a thing I'd remember.
It might not be the hollowed out skeleton of a whale, but there's definitely like lots of whale bone on the way in.
Is it really Susan Sarandon?
I believe so, yes. I mean, not like the real Susan Sarandon, but...
Well, that was my question, because I'd remember her.
The actress is really Susan Sarandon.
Oh, maybe I finished it.
I mean, whales are absolutely like everywhere in that game, like
whales and rats.
Well, like the whole mythology built around the whale thing. I really like the amount of like jellied eels and stuff in that game. Like all the food is really appropriate to both the sort of Victorian sort of setting.
Have I mixed it up then? Is there whale meat?
Yeah, there is whale meat, okay. But there's also jelly deals. And it creates a nice sort of, I don't know, like, it's all kind of gross. And that game suits everything being a little bit gross and oily and industrial and tinned and kind of...
I was just thinking that, actually. Like, it's so appropriate. And, like, yeah, that sort of, that grimness and the sort of... the salty kind of brininess of it and the sort of packaged...
The way salty, it's briny game design.
Yeah, yeah.
The phrase jelly deal was very evocative, actually. Like, you could almost the slightly slimy texture of it in your mouth. So you can...
And that sort of, yeah, and that bitter fish skin. Like, I think all those tastes are appropriate to
like that game as well. It used particularly evocative foods. Like, it didn't have any... bland kind
of... You found a big chicken dinner.
Well, yeah, or stuff that was particularly just ubiquitous. It had a very distinctive palate, basically.
Yeah interesting.
Yeah. It makes a very interesting comparison, again, with a game that apparently I'm not going to stop kicking the shit out of this podcast for some reason 3 years after the fact, Bioshock Infinite, which obviously, like, the eating candy floss out of bins thing is, like, you know, a famous bit of lewd narrative dissonance.
Glug.
But it's not just that, it's the fact that eating out of bins is that anyway. It's that the food doesn't... I don't know if it,
my favorite thing was that the food doesn't actually correspond to the containers that it's in because it's so randomized. Like, you'll go into that sweet shop and then you'll open the boxes of chocolates or candy or whatever, and it's like, you found an orange.
And you're a
like,
ham.
Sure. Okay, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's... they might be trying to tell, you know, say something about, you know, festivities that were going on or whatever with the candy floss and the stuff everywhere, but it doesn't really work. It's quite a subtle thing. Maybe you're so attuned to implied taste that it does colour the world. To
yeah. The, like, a lot of RPGs and things kind of semi-randomly populate generic box or investigate items you can investigate with a semi-random selection of items, and that can often be like, you found some cotton and half a chicken and a spoon. And
whose storage solution was this?
That's my handbag.
Yeah, it actually is.
And it feels like, I don't know, it seems like a lot of effort to craft. Like, Dishonored definitely seems to put things in sensible places.
Yeah. Mm.
So you find tins of food in the right places, and that also feeds into the consistency of the world, you know.
I think one of the things that has occurred to me off the back of the Bioshock Infinite conversation, though, is that I think that the food stuffs are actually appropriate to the game. It's just the placement right. that fucks it all up.
Yeah, bins.
Because Colombia and the sort of the tinge, well, not tinge, but the Americana-ness of it all, you know, lends itself to those American funfair foods.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that you're ferreting them out of bins and they're not in any sensible places, and the whole thing just feels so video gamesy as all hell
yeah.
that it permanently, not permanently, but it continuously disrupts any immersion that you might have developed for the game.
A bit like how we have sort of instinctive sense of what's, you know, what sense of food conveys. Like, it's also really distracting and gamey most of the time because, you know, you were pointing this out earlier, Tom, but like, food never works like it works.
Right.
Like, food straight up healing you is obviously bullshit. But even the Bioshock thing of like, you get a bit of Eve or magic power or whatever back if you smoke, but you also immediately lose some health, yeah. which is like equivalent to being a bit shot. And I would not contest that smoking is bad for your health, particularly your long-term health. But when you smoke a cigarette, you don't think, oh, I'm slightly better at casting spells now, but I do feel like I've been slightly shot.
No.
Like,
not quite the same, is it?
It's for all the attempted verisimilitude of other aspects of experience reflected in the game,
yeah.
that is so abstract. You might as well be picking up fucking stars or coins, big floating golden spinning coins, you know?
Something which I feel really annoyed about in terms of food is Guild Wars 2. And this is partly my own fault, because the person who I first spoke to about it, or who was first telling me about it, was Quinn Smith. And he was so excited about Guild Wars 2 at the time, and was telling me about how he had discovered you could make toast, and that was the most exciting thing, and he banged on about it. And I was like, toast is one of my interest groups, and I was similarly excited. And then when I finally played Guild Wars 2, it was like, this isn't real toast at all. This is video games toast, where you just shove some ingredients in an MMO box and it tells you you've made toast. And that's like,
I got such a huge XP bonus for discovering toast that I leveled up to level 31.
but that's the annoyance for me with that game, because it's got such wonderfully like evocative names for the foods that you can craft. I mean, you know, they're things that I love and I have very strong emotional attachments to, and sort of those comfort food associations with some of them, and they're foods that I feel like you don't just get to say exist and like, you know.
If you're going to show me toast, bring me a piece of toast.
Well, if you're going to talk to me about hot buttered toast, then you need to have brought something to the table other than the words hot buttered toast. Like, that has to mean
I'm going to slow you down a little bit here, Bib. How the does a game achieve that thing you're asking it to achieve?
Well, I think it's more like how it's bandying the words about, Chris. And so what I'm...
I think we're allowed to say hot buttered toast without offering a piece of hot buttered toast. Although I'm not going to attempt that.
You just need to be careful when you're deploying it. But when I was, when we were talking about Dishonored and how it has a very definite palette and it corresponds to the game and and the emotions that you associate or that the food elicits from you when you hear the words or you actually sort of take a second to think about what that food would involve, it corresponds to the rest of what the game does. Whereas when you've just got this mad long list of names of food in this menu that just extends and is MMO-ish, like, I loved that toast was included, but it didn't, it lost its meaning, if that makes sense.
Like, meaningless toast. Did you have a mild existential crisis around?
These things have a meaning, Tom. You can't just go throwing toast into the equation and then expect people not to be disappointed when it doesn't elicit any sense of sort of being comforted or fulfilled or happy or warm.
I perfectly enjoyed Guild Wars' toast.
There's a few things.
Well, I don't play Guild Wars, so. And it's entirely because of toast disappointment.
There's a few things that tie spin off this, actually. It's interesting. So, when you're mousing over Dishonored's world, you're kind of just looking at things. It pops up, right, with the text. And those just like short phrases are. They really. The power of words means that that just feeds into your overall impression of the game. And that's part of the 3D environment that if you mouse over those jelly deals, you see it's a tin. And it's jelly deals, and that feeds into everything. Whereas, obviously, in a stale menu, you're never going to get a sense that it's actually a physical object anyway. Like a lot of things in MMOs, it's just like an XP
You'd
mechanic.
Get it with a game that glories in language in the way that something like Failbetter's projects do. So I think that would probably have...
They'd make their hot butter toast would be really fucking Cthulian.
It would be meaningful.
It would mean something.
You deploy toast.
A cyclopean slice of toast looks at you from across the bar. It winks. You wink back.
The other thing is, in Dishonored particularly, has an incredible, and Bioshock and other games have this as well, and Thief even has incredible noise for eating things. The noise of crunching.
You're
into
like a silent man dressed entirely in silk.
With the loudest eating noise. Crunch. Ear-splitting crunch. And it's not just the sound of a person eating something. It's the sound of being inside a skull that is eating something with all of the kind of bass sound that implies, the sound of the vibrations going through teeth and into, you know, your ear canals.
How rare it is that games contextually alter that sound based on the type of food you are eating. Because, you know, an apple would sound incredibly different to, you know, a
jelly
slice
deals.
Of toast or some a trifle.
Yeah, God, I'd love that level of. Come on, Star Citizen, you've done like you've promised the universe. I want different food sounds for different space food that I eat. Come on,
that would be good. Although in space, they could probably argue that everything would be in little packets,
like pills,
dehydrated packets of ice cream and things.
Soylent Brown. Lovely. Well, I'm pretty sure we've answered that question.
Yeah,
adequately,
and then some.
Yeah. That is. All of the time we have for questions.
Also, I'm really hungry.
No, I am as well, actually.
Who wants toast? Yeah. If you'd like to sneeze, then you're me. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode of the podcast, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. You can tweet us on the Twitter at Creighton Crowbar. Why would that take me so long to remember after 149 episodes? Who knows? You can... leave a question on the forum, creatingcrowbar.com/forum, and you can discuss the episode on both the forum and on our Discord channel, which is, well, we'll put a link in the show notes and there's a link in the sidebar of the website. If you would like to follow us as individuals, I am at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Tom is?
At PCG Ludo, which is L-E-D-O.
And Pip is?
At Philippa War, which is at PHILIPPAWARR.
Thanks for listening, everybody.